K-Mud Podcast presents.
Dirty job. Somebody's got to do it. I'm in the hot seat right now. This is the Politically Correct Week in Review with me, Josh. My co-host Charlie is still away. Last week, somebody called towards the end of the show and started talking about climate change, which we had ignored because of all the other distractions that are going on politically around the world. And so if that person wants to call in and get towards climate change earlier in the show, that would be good. On the climate change thing, I heard a report recently from a researcher, scientist, climate scientist who was a victim of the LA fires and took it upon himself, having a young child and wanting to feel safe, started testing the after effects of the fires in LA, and much to his horror discovered that the contamination was pretty prevalent, not just in places that were actually burned down, but in the surrounding areas. People that sheltered in place and closed all the doors and windows have high levels of lead and various other nasty chemicals on all the surfaces of their homes. And he's counseling that people take precaution to clean that stuff off. This is a thing that doesn't really get studied as much. And so there's, I think it's UCLA is launching a 10-year study on the after effects of this kind of disaster. And, you know, it's pretty clear that the modern building materials and all the chemicals that are used in buildings these days, burning up and depositing themselves in the atmosphere, aren't a good deal. I've got family in Hawaii in proximity to the volcano that's going off right now, and they have to deal with, as they call Pele's hair, microscopic, you know, tiny fibers of glass that are light enough to float through the air and become dust. That's pretty nasty stuff. So there's that. I mean, it's not like we don't know that the climate is bad and getting worse. The results of our human habitation here, we just can't help but foul our nests. I got some good news about climate. I was perusing. I discovered that Neil Young has a website, neilyoungarchives.com, and on that website, he's got a pretty extensive news feed going. He's got Democracy, Free Press, American Voices, Women, World, Earth, Tech, Health, Climate, Science, Oceans, Law, etc. As we know, have you heard that Neil Young was in front of a crowd in downtown LA yesterday with Joan Baez and AOC and Bernie? 36,000 people in the streets protesting what's going on in Washington. So anyway, Neil Young's Earth page on his site of news pointed me to a Supreme Court. I missed this in the news, so this is good. This is how it's supposed to work, news that you can go back to, because this happened last month. The Supreme Court rejected an effort to block states from suing oil companies. So the justices declined to hear an unusual argument from Republican-led states that sought to end lawsuits against energy companies over their role in global warming. The way it was phrased was, you know, that 19 Republicans' attorneys general representing states like Alabama, West Virginia, were trying to prevent other states led by Democrats from pursuing lawsuits against the oil industry. And those two states include California, Connecticut, Minnesota. So this is like the front lines of like us and them-ism, I guess. It's like the people that, no, don't hold anybody accountable for what they do within their business versus, yes, we need to hold people accountable so they stop doing this sort of thing. Of course, we know how it's going to go. I mean, in the end, these people were, the Democratic states were now allowed to continue with their lawsuits, but that's going to go on for a while and no doubt be appealed to the Supreme Court again and on a different, I mean, this denial was, you know, prudent of the Supreme Court. They're waiting to see what the trial brings up before they look at it, as they should, you know. they should be adjudicated first. And then in the end, the Supreme Court gets to weigh in, not just please help us squash this in the beginning, or quash, I guess is what they say in legal parlance. Oh boy. So that was my climate bits. I've been very distracted by what's going on with the economy, the ebb and flow of tariffs on, tariffs off, wax on, wax off. And it struck me that no doubt there are people in Trump's orbit that are making all kinds of money off the extreme changes in the stock market, because that's what those people do. The people that make money by moving money around, there are tricks and tactics and short selling where you basically gamble that the stock market's going to crash. And if it does, you make a bunch of money. Adam Schiff has announced an investigation into insider trading, which in Congress will probably won't get any traction. But Senator Elizabeth Warren brought up the fact that somebody like Letitia James in New York, a New York prosecutor, could do the same thing, look into insider trading allegations and investigate. The thing about financial trading is it's recorded. People know who bought what when. And as they say, just ask Martha Stewart. She actually went to prison for insider trading. But it was pretty clear, if you looked at the stock market blips, you know, the market graph, about 10 minutes before Trump announced that he was pulling back on tariffs and that the stock market flew high all of a sudden, about 10 minutes before that, there was this little blip of sell-offs that people were activating, the precursor of the big rise in stock sales. And just no doubt these people are making money. I mean, that's just the business they're in. And in fact, I saw a clip. I can't vouch for the veracity of the clip. I didn't look into it, but it just made sense that Trump was pointing to people in the Oval Office, his inner circle there, and saying, and he made X number of billions of dollars, and he did pretty good. He made some money, and everybody in the room's laughing. And meanwhile, citizens at home who were relying on their retirement benefits that are tied up in the stock market were cringing and tearing their hair out, wondering if they're in ruins. I can't remember who it was now, but one of the inner circle there, I can't remember if it was the Secretary of the Treasury or the Commerce or somebody, was being interviewed and brought up the idea that I know the Treasury Secretary said, when asked about the stock market, he said, well, he was very pleased that the infrastructure held, you know, that it didn't just crash completely and have it in total chaos, you know, that they've got the infrastructure now to maintain this wildly divergent market that seesaws back and forth. But one of those guys, in context of explaining the bond market and everything, said, you know, it's a confidence game. And I don't think it did occur to him to think that he just used the words confidence game in a way that, you know, was innocent. He was thinking, you know, yes, of course, the financial markets are all about confidence in the markets and confidence in the strength of the dollar and all that. But confidence game has a very different meaning when you subtract some of the letters and call it a con game. And of course, con games are criminal acts that lead to financial loss. And the con in that phrase refers to confidence, because it's creating confidence that is placed erroneously in something that costs you money in the end. So admitting that the markets are a confidence game is kind of bald-faced of them. I read something. I didn't get a full analysis on it, but this is the way it's going these days. I feel so distracted by, and I think this is a strategy and tactic of the powers that be right now, is to, as Steve Bannon calls it, flood the zone, with material and information and conflict so that it's hard to focus. And they're being rather successful because I usually have focused on a few things in the past, and it's getting harder and harder. I don't know if I'm getting older and older, or I couldn't remember Elizabeth Warren's name the other day. I was thinking, wait a minute, oh, the senator from Massachusetts, what's her name? Anyway, the idea that flooding the zone makes it difficult to focus on things. I don't know if I didn't have the bandwidth to research it. I didn't look into it, but I read a piece in which it indicated that when the tariff thing was first introduced, all these days ago, I mean, it's only been, what, a week, 10 days that all this chaos has occurred. The new Canadian prime minister met in Europe with, you know, the very influential leaders of France, Germany, England, and apparently Japan was in the room as well, and discussed response tactics. And one of the things that they came up with and did it in sort of a measured way, if anybody's aware, that a lot of these countries invest in our treasury by buying bonds that we rely on to run our world here in this country. Treasury bonds are deemed, you know, high-class investments that get a lot of traction in the financial markets and are a trusted investment, pay dividends, you know. And so one of the things that these European countries and Canada did is decide to start slowly selling off bonds. It would be deemed irresponsible to just sell everything all at once because that would really cause panic. So they kind of let it be known. I guess this is part of the negotiations. Trump touts, or as he put it, people were getting a little queasy. They were getting yippy, meaning leaders of foreign countries were threatening that they were going to methodically sell off U.S. Treasury bonds. And you know, basically create a tailspin in the finances of the government. So they backed off and changed direction, and creating more unpredictability in the market. And it's been a little crazy. Yeah, they're getting yippy, which I don't even know where we got that term. It's I think of Abby Hoffman when I hear the word yippy. So, you know, that's always been the danger of imposing outlandish tariffs, is other countries respond. They want to protect their interests and will do things that perhaps we won't like. And, you know, creating a trade war out of absolutely zero, no reason, and justifying it by saying that we're being ripped off because we're trading with, you know, valuable trade partners around the world. You know, we give them money, they give us stuff, everybody wins, but that's deemed a ripoff. It's a little crazy. Hey, it looks like we got a call, so let's see what they have to say. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm glad you're talking about the economy, because I believe the economy is at the root of what drives what's going on in with government or policy, but I've been trying to figure out what's going on too, and sorting through all the hype, and basically found a guy I think is real knowledgeable. He's on YouTube, or he's one of the, you know, people that are being interviewed by all kinds of different podcasters, or and his name's Martin Armstrong. Mm-hmm. He's been in the business for a long time, and he's all about business. And he's definitely, you know, leans way more to the right than left. But he basically said something to the effect of that basically what Trump's doing is like archaic and not going to be good for the U.S. economy.
Yeah,
with that, he didn't fall in line with most the other hype I was watching online, which is seems to be like more doomsday, like things are going to crash by buy gold and silver now. And he's all like, no. So he's got an AI computer, he says, that has 50 years of data, and it's predicted like the last bunch of elections accurately. And he basically says that the U.S. economy is not going to crash, at least not yet. He basically said that what's going on in Europe with, particularly, he said, France, but basically Europe and NATO is marching to war with Russia within the next couple of years. And he said that drives the bond markets in Europe. You know, basically people flee the bond markets because he said essentially if you go to war, you don't have to pay the bonds back or whatever after the war or something. So there's all kinds of debt issues with a lot of the European countries, and that's kind of pushing them into this war footing. But essentially, he said all that money has no place else to go other than large markets, particularly like basically the U.S. I don't know if he's right about that, but yeah. That's what he claims. So his computer says, you know, things, I think he saw a low in with the U.S. economy, and I want to say maybe 2028, and that would kind of fall in line. Well, I was going to say fall in line with like kind of war outbreak in Europe and Russia. But essentially, he did say that his computer has the dollar currency basically crashing or failing by 2032. And he said what that means is that essentially when the Fed prints money, they have to, well, I don't know if they or they loan the money to banks, but basically U.S. treasuries or bonds, same thing, have to be posted to match those, that new money. And if nobody buys the debt,
right,
that's when the currency collapses.
Yeah.
And so Trump's doing a good job of like increasing uncertainty and driving, you know, at least the international community away from the U.S. buying more U.S. debt when we just use that against them, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that gets left out of the equation when foreign countries like China or Japan or somebody sell us products for dollars. They often will reinvest that money in treasury bonds or in real estate in the United States. I mean, you know, wealthy people in China have been buying up U.S. real estate to invest their earnings safely, because they're not really allowed to do that in the same way in China. And so, yeah, it's like we start demonizing Chinese investment and drive that away. And then all of a sudden there's going to be a bunch of houses on the market that can't sell, which is, of course, what triggered the 2008 crisis with all the defaulted loans for housing and so on. And yeah, it's just not a good plan. It's a pretty regular cycle of collapse. You know, I went through and saw the dates. You know, you can chart through history, U.S. history. It's cyclical where, you know, crisis happens economically. You know, things go well and then they crash, and they go well and then they crash. And it's sort of logical that we're going to have another one. And the thing that's crazy making is the current crisis in the making was completely optional. Based
on, are you talking about the current U.S. Economic situation?
Yeah, I mean the current thing based on Trump's whims, basically. You know, that one guy's idea of what something is happening dominates the scene, and he's wrong. You know, it's people that know more than he does, people that are smarter than him, are well aware that the policies dead on arrival, you know, and that things should change or else. I mean, it's a crazy thing that there's an economics professor who laid it out, saying that in one way, you know, Trump is saying that it ought to be this way, you know, that tariffs will do two things. First, they'll raise $6 trillion paid for by other countries. And second, they will revitalize American manufacturing and generate new high-paying jobs and wealth, which is mathematically impossible because you can't have both of those things come true. If you're going to negotiate trade issues and, you know, make a whole bunch of money that way, we'll continue to buy from foreign countries and get a bunch of money, right, with the tariffs. But if we don't do that and we revitalize American industry, then we won't be getting tariffs. So we won't be getting that money. And of course, you know, nobody wants to invest in new factories in this market with uncertainty ahead. And not only that, but you have to pay Americans American wages. And of course, that's really out the window when you get child labor and minimum wage to build televisions. I don't, you know. So, of course, the latest thing was exempting electronics from China, which, you know, is a major portion of electronic.
We lost that caller, but we want to ask them to call back, and we have another caller on the line.
Okay. That's fine. Hello, caller.
Hey. I'm not an economics expert, but I've been looking at it for 70-some years and have a math background. We buy into this delusion worldwide to an extent, or maybe it's just in our culture. This abstraction we call money, it's an abstraction. It's a way that we can exchange with each other. But the way it's being dealt with and the way we buy into it, and I have to buy into it too. I live in the culture.
Yeah.
But it's insane. I mean, it's just total insanity. The Great Depression didn't need to happen. There was plenty of ability to produce. There was plenty of food to go around. There was plenty of labor that could have been put to work if it wanted to be. But there's this wonderful game in the background that makes an enormous amount of money for a few because they can play it right.
Yeah, the depression.
Just one more point to throw in, which is the Treasury does invent money.
Yeah.
All the time. It doesn't require getting loans, you know, getting banks to ask for a loan from the feds. We just do it all the time. Your turn. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You know, when the Treasury prints money and it gets delivered to banks, then the banks can loan out more money. And when you loan out money, it creates on the books a debt, which then makes it possible to loan out more money based on the potential debt. It's a very complicated formula of how debt and money operates. And it is a confidence game. It takes confidence in the system to make it fly. Of course, during the Depression, wealthy people did not suffer. It was the people that had been enthralled by the concept of getting wealthy and investing their life savings that hit the rocks and jumped out of windows, had to sell everything. The people that were already wealthy got wealthier. The people that were already poor stayed poor. It was, you know, the middle class was the great disaster. So now the Depression has such a bad name that we call it recession. Sounds a little better. Was that another call, Javi?
I got that on the line when I got hung up on.
Mm. Yeah.
And I missed most of what you said. but I have a sense that we're probably basically in agreement.
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember what I said now, but the it's another one of these things. It just keeps coming.
Yeah.
Thanks
for the show. Thanks for all the work you guys put in.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate your thinking.
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, and of course, tomorrow is tax day. We'll see how that goes. Word is the White House wants to spend $45 billion this year on facilities to detain non-citizens. That sounds, $45 billion. Well, last year, the total amount of federal money allocated to ICE, the total for everything that ICE was doing was $3.4 billion. So more than 10 times more of the money. Of course, they're going to need that money to do the things they want to do. And as it next topic
they're a wonderful enforcement device to be able to use, and not only against immigrants. We're watching the dissent relative to the politic. I don't want to live in World War II, Germany, Italy.
Yeah.
Don't want to live in the Soviet Union either.
Yeah.
It's a crazy making time.
Yeah. You know, I recently saw, the famous Martin Niemöller quote, first they came for.
Yeah.
How's it go? I'm quickly looking it up here, so I didn't want to mangle it too badly, but I'm not sure I'm going to find it that way. Anyway, it was pointed out recently that that was not a warning. When he said that, he had been a supporter of the Nazi Party. He voted for Nazis three times. He was a Lutheran pastor and, thought, they got some good ideas. He was rather anti-Semitic. But he had a change of heart, as a good, spiritually inclined man should, I suppose. But the thing is, it wasn't a warning he was giving when he said, first they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. It was not a warning. It was a regret that he hadn't acted sooner, because he went on to be an activist for human rights got on the right side of stuff. And so he regretted having not come to that sooner and not being responsible to speak up at the time. And how much of that was fear or how much of that was his beliefs at the time? And, it's how it happens. There's a funny take on that. I have a funny in a sardonic way. First, they came for the journalists, and I did not speak out. And then I don't know what happened. Because there was nobody reporting on it anymore. And of course, that's what's happening now. Trump just went on a tirade proud to be suing 60 Minutes, suing 60 Minutes for editing Kamala Harris's interview that made her look better than she really was, trying to get her elected, which I'm not sure how that's a thing you could sue somebody for. But, going railing on about how 60 Minutes is fake news and it's not a news organization and CBS and Paramount are all corrupt and radical and anti-Trump. And therefore, they should lose their license and be punished. And they're going to tell the FCC to look into it. And
there's this thing about projection.
Yeah.
There's this thing about warning us about people like me.
Mm-hmm.
And not realizing that I'm like that.
Yeah. And it's sort of what came down just today is New York Times is reporting, or New York Post, I'm sorry. I just saw, I was just sent this in-house here at the station. The White House has begun to notify Congress of its request to eliminate all, quote unquote, all public broadcasting funding and codify foreign aid cuts identified by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had hearings with NPR and PBS executives, and now citing lengthy anti-conservative bias and cites waste, fraud, and abuse at USAID, et cetera, et cetera. It's beginning, you know, calling out. This is the beginning of that kind of phenomenon. And meanwhile, I heard that tariffs with Canada would affect the newsprint supply, which a majority of newsprint comes from Canadian forests used for newspapers, and the newspapers would affect most radically are small town, small press newspapers that are already on the fringe and can't afford to operate very well. And now the cost of paper is going to go up and probably put some of them out of business.
You know, in terms of, you've been speaking of journalism in the press. I've been an activist since mid-60s, whenever my life allowed it. Of the thousands of things I've been at and done and seen, I was able to, I could recognize maybe two or three of them from what got reported.
Yeah.
It doesn't, what we don't get, I studied history for quite a while, world history, and who knows what actually happened?
Yeah. The victors is the way they usually say it. Yeah.
Who wrote it down?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is an important aspect of journalism. I mean, you know, true journalism is about reporting what's happening. And, you know, it gets put in archives and libraries and can be looked back upon to see what happens. You know, that is the history that we can more accurately rely on rather than somebody's, I mean, you know, it requires training journalists to actually report on things that are happening, not just report press releases. And there was an amusing thing. Lauren Boebert was questioning Oliver Stone in a hearing about JFK, you know, and so now that the JFK archives have been released, and telling Oliver Stone, you wrote a book that indicated that LBJ was in a conspiracy to kill the president, right? And he looked at his lawyer and he looked at her and he said, no, I didn't. And she said, yes, you did. And he said, I made a movie in which I implied from some information that I had received that LBJ may have been complicit in the cover-up of the conspiracy, you know, and that's as far as he went. And his lawyer piped in and said, Ms. Boebert, I believe that you're referring to a statement by Roger Stone, not my client, Oliver Stone. Yeah. So it's like that. Yeah.
Well, that's closer to the truth than one would expect from her.
Yeah. I think we've got another caller in the waiting.
I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Call back.
Okay.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
And I'm calling back.
Okay.
I'm the first caller.
Okay.
I'll try not to drag on, but just in comment to your news and journalism, real journalism can be a very dangerous job. Like, lots of them are getting killed these days for trying to expose truth. The second thing that's been on my mind has been, you know, there was a show on the BBC about the benefits and negatives of, you know, online books versus the hard copy. And they basically said, oh, isn't this great? It's, you know, available to that many more people. But then they also talked about licensing and, you know, terms of how many people could have it at one time and how, you know, sometimes it's there and then it's gone. And, you know, in this day and age of like giant, you know, online companies that basically control our access to things, you can bet, you know, that information is going to be one of the, you know, is one of the most important things that they can control. And so my whole thing is like, you know, they can go in and rewrite or just make unavailable, you know, hordes of books, literature, ideas, and news.
Yeah,
that may not be available to future citizens.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think holding on to the hard copy books, especially, you know, some of the classics, some of the banned books, you know, just seems to me like if there was a place to store them safely, where they wouldn't be under threat of being burned or whatever, would be a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for calling in, but do try to limit.
Can I make one more comment?
Okay, but we do try to get other people on the air too. So,
is there somebody up right after me?
I'm not sure right now. But
okay, let me make one more comment. My comment is for all those diehard Democrats out there. I'll just state I'm neither Democrat nor Republican, and I think the whole thing is driven by money. I think Jim was talking about that on Sunday's open forum. But basically, for everyone that thinks that the Democrats are going to save us from Donald Trump, the reason Donald Trump is in office is because the Democrats did what they've done, which has basically been anti-democratic and censoring and employing a lot of similar tactics, but maybe more subtlety than you know, Donald Trump. So I'm not saying what he's doing is good. In fact, right. I think it's taken a sledgehammer to a lot of critical infrastructure. But
yeah.
The Democrats are not going to save you if we keep the same. I mean, maybe if the progressives somehow can take over power, but leadership in the Democrats so, is just as evil.
Yeah, no, I got some. I got Republicans. The next thing I wanted to mention. I'll go there.
I'll get off air and listen off air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Yeah, I was just pointed to a website earlier today by a friend, runforsomething.net. And the mission of this organization is recruiting and supporting young progressives to run for office. And they've got, you know, basically teach you how to do it and support you in that. It's the thing that, you know, the Tea Party rose to some level of notoriety. And then, you know, of course, MAGA is like Tea Party on steroids. But the idea that the right has been doing is winning school board elections, running for local offices, dog catcher, et cetera, you know, to create a base of support for their trip. And so this organization, Run for Something, is encouraging young people to step up and run for office at, you know, whatever level you feel you can handle, and therefore build people that are experienced in that sort of activity and into the future. And of course, politics, progressive politics, is all about evolution. It's not, there's never really been a successful revolutionary moment where everything's fixed. And in fact, more often than not, revolutions lead to things not being fixed or becoming terrible in their own right. So a slow evolution of winning local offices that leads to statewide offices, county offices, statewide offices, up into the, you know, up through the ranks, and building that cadre of people that know what they're doing is really the only reason we have any kind of progressive politics at all right now, is because that's what people have done in the past. You know, for all the faults of the federal government, we have to look at it, admit that we have made some progress over the decades, centuries of our advancement here, that things have changed very slowly and, you know, painfully slowly at times. But
there seems to be a move now to undo a lot of progress for its own sake. You know, the idea of this anti-wokeness, which is really oxymoronic, you know, to say I'm against wokeness. I don't believe in woke. Well, woke is a term for being awake, for recognizing the realities of the situation and your place in it and the history and legacy of the struggle that people have made and so on. The original meaning of being woke is to be aware, to be awake. And so if you're anti-woke, it means you want to be asleep. You don't want to pay attention. You don't want to be involved. And we see that happening now with, like, you know, take away mentioning of slavery because it makes our country look bad. We don't want to talk about that anymore. We don't want to think about it. As though history of where we've been is a bad thing that distorts truth and, you know, or makes people feel uncomfortable. Yeah, you should feel uncomfortable about slavery. That's why we don't have it anymore. And if we get comfortable with the idea of slavery again, who knows what will happen in the future? Evolution can work both ways. You can select for, you know, raising livestock, you can select for positive traits and you can select for negative traits. And you can do that inadvertently sometimes by saying, oh, look, that dog's so cute. I need to breed that more. And then before you know it, you got hip problems because the dogs are inbred. And, you know, I'm torturing a metaphor, but it's like that. We need to evolve. It's clear. And yeah, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm an unaffiliated person, actually, and I don't strongly believe in the party system. I had a little moment with the Green Party there, but, you know, it was a fantasy, you know, that the Green Party was going to win anything, and especially if they go to sleep every 4 years and don't come to life again until there's a presidential election that they know they're going to lose. They should be running for something, which is the whole message I started here with. Being progressive means running for office, getting elected, doing the work. And, you know, democracy is not necessarily the most glamorous thing to be involved in. It gets ugly. There's money involved. It is encouraging to see that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is getting such a national recognition. You know, she's one Congress member from the state of New York amongst many. And apparently her district loves her because she's being reelected several times. And so there's rumors out there that she's more popular than Chuck Schumer. And if she ran for senator in New York, it remains to be seen if she would actually, you know, have the traction in statewide. But because of her messaging, I mean, she's very consistent. She is a Democrat. She toes the line of party politics to a degree, but is just progressive to her core, you know, and people respond to that because it makes sense. And I guess people respond to the other side too because it makes sense to them, because they don't know that it doesn't make sense because they haven't been educated. They have been, the information they get has been narrowed down. And in terms of the books, people, the previous caller referred to books and storing books. Well, in the long run, books don't matter, I have to say. I mean, the human story will be gone. Books become solid chunks of carbon that nobody can read. It's all about us here now. You know, it's nice to think that we can archive the future of the world or the past of the world into the future. There's been lots of information lost through history. The Library of Alexandria burned and, you know, the resources of the ages at that point disappeared. Who knows what they had? Of course, one electromagnetic pulse away from losing everything online, including the banking system. It's a friend of mine who strongly advocates backing up your computer constantly, all the time, referred to, the analogy was, it's like doing a very fine painting, a masterpiece on a piece of glass that any moment can break. And it's really true. That's as things get smaller and smaller and denser, it's even more true that information can just blink out overnight. I recently had problems sending emails. I'd send an email, my mail app said it was sent, and that people didn't get the message. So where'd it go? I don't know. And if you don't get a response, you don't know that it wasn't sent, and that's confounding, yeah. We're going to have to figure out better ways to deal with communication for sure, especially if defunding of things like public radio goes down. Somewhere in my little stash of books, I still have the pamphlet on how to do pirate radio that somebody produced in the 80s in the Bay Area. I did build a crystal radio once. The idea that the technology exists, you know, as long as you got some spare parts. There used to be a thing. Kids used to go around the neighborhood looking for old TVs and stuff so they could scavenge out parts and make new things. And that's gone by the wayside. Whether or not people know how their computer works is a big question. As we become more and more reliant on them, fewer and fewer people actually know how they're built or how they operate, hardware and software. And all relies on the mega international commerce system, and which is trying to be destroyed now by the whims of one guy who doesn't quite get it. So I'm rambling now, and there's 10 minutes to the hour. Give me a call if you got something to add. Otherwise, I'm going to look up a few more things. One thing I wanted to mention, I wanted to mention last time because it came up, we were talking about the deportation thing, which is still alive as we speak. President of El Salvador was in Washington, D.C. today, and you know, there's been several orders to return this one particular fellow who had legal status in this country and has been admitted that he was deported due to an administrative error. We're sorry, but can't do anything about it, even though the court says we should or can't do it. El Salvadoran president says, I'm not going to do that. Well, of course, the guy is an El Salvadoran citizen who fled the country under threat of gang violence. And now he's in a prison surrounded by gangsters. We don't, you know, maybe we can't do anything about it because he's no longer living. We don't know. And of course, the threat now is Trump would love to be sending U.S. citizens to El Salvador. He's stated as much. If there's a way to do it, we don't know, but if there's a way to do it, and of course, him saying this, the press secretary touted the transparency of his statement. We want to be transparent. He's saying this. Yeah, but the authority to do that flies in the face of his oath of office. So what are we hearing here? He says violent criminals, but, you know, maybe others too. But it doesn't matter. Violent criminals have a right to due process. And in fact, one of the Venezuelan gang members that was deported to El Salvador was being prosecuted, and they dropped the prosecution in order to deport him. And a former prosecutor, federal prosecutor, said this is unheard of. We have always historically and you know, reasonably first convicted these people before we deport them so they can never come back again. So, yeah, there's that. But what I wanted to mention is that the judge that was responsible for pushing back James Boasberg, the federal judge that Trump called a radical left-wing lunatic judge and went on to say he didn't win popular vote and blah, blah. He didn't win seven swing states. He didn't win anything. I won for many reasons in an overwhelming mandate, blah, blah, blah. This judge, like so many of the crooked judges I'm forced to appear before, should be impeached. We don't want vicious, violent, demented criminal, blah, blah, blah. He went on and on. Well, Judge Boasberg, who was a roommate at Yale with Brett Kavanaugh, served as a top homicide prosecutor in D.C.,
as federal judge stopped the release of Trump's tax returns, forced the release of Hillary's emails, gave lenient sentence to January 6 rioters, is a close friend of John Roberts, served as the presiding judge of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and was appointed to the bench not by Barack Obama, as Trump claims, but by George W. Bush. So the idea that a judge who goes against Trump, like a reporter who goes against a Trump, should be punished for this act is just, I don't even know what to say about it. And the fact is that the more this happens, the more we look at it as normal behavior by the commander-in-chief, the Overton window of acceptance moves further to the right. And so when Steve Bannon comes out and says, you know, Trump absolutely will run and be elected in 2028 in defiance of the Constitution, and is asked, how's that going to work because it's against the law? He says, well, we're working on it. Well, this is to soften us up so that in 4 years, it's not so radical an idea. They've been talking about it. They've been working on it. So just making things more and more acceptable that way seems to be the tactic. So the prosecutor that tried to levy the case why we can't return this deportee wasn't vigorous enough in his defense of the Trump administration, because when asked by the judge, you know, what grounds, et cetera, he said, Your Honor, I'm not sure. I don't have that information. That wasn't vigorous enough. He was fired. I don't know if he was let go completely, but he was taken off the case, removed from the job he was doing. And more and more people are being punished for being that way, being honest. So, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be allowed to be on the air. I mean, they can come and get me, right? Because the fact is, if they can deport somebody accidentally with no due process, no habeas corpus, no recourse, they can do that to anybody. And that's always been the fear. That's why the writ of habeas corpus is in the Bill of Rights, that you have the right to demand of the government authority that has detained you, as it is in Latin. The habeas corpus in Latin means show me the body. Tell me what it is that I'm here for. Prove to me that you have a case against me. And if that can't be done, you're supposed to be let go. The court is supposed to intercede in that authority. Checks and balances are going down the tube, so I'm not sure where that leaves us all. On a happy note, do what you can. Now's the time to speak up, because at some point, who knows? You know, write a book. Don't just read a book. Write a book. Relate your experiences in the real world to other people. Step up when you see somebody being ostracized or demonized or called out for something that seems perfectly reasonable. Stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't say that. I mean, you know, mob rule depends on a mob, and we are the mob. So let's be a good mob. How about that? You know, the hue and cry. Before there was police, the method of law enforcement was the hue and cry. Somebody on the street gets robbed. Somebody says, hey, that person just got robbed. And everybody says, hey, that person just got robbed. And they start chasing them down the street. And that's how somebody gets apprehended. Police only came in and as a tool of government oppression. So to keep the unionists in line and keep the slaves in line. And thanks, Javi, for engineering. I'm getting hoarse because I carried the whole show by myself with only two callers. And I'll be ready to do it again in a couple of weeks. I may be remote at that point.
This has been a KMUT podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.